Here's the thing. Ever wonder why aspiring authors spend so much time trying to crack the code about how to get published? That's because no one who's in the daily grind like me has put all the pieces together in one place. It's Carly Waters here, and as your senior literary agent on the podcast with 15 years of experience in publishing, selling books, and teaching the business of publishing, I'm here to give you the clarity that will turn this hobby into a career. Inside my course, The Author's Publishing Playbook, we have monthly live Q&A sessions to cover your specific issues. But for the rest, there are over 40 video lessons that equal 10 hours of learning with professionally edited transcripts. The course will solve all your writerly problems, except write your book for you. That's on you. My course is a masterclass designed to teach writers how to prepare, pitch, publish, and promote their book in today's competitive publishing landscape. It's for career-driven writers, aspiring and published, who want to understand how to succeed in the business of books. There are over 20 worksheets, downloads, and plug-and-play templates for editing, querying, and marketing. You get lifetime access for the entire 6-module course as soon as you purchase. As new content gets added, you have access to that as well. Don't forget, there's a mobile app on top of computer access you can learn on the go. Get started today to gain the career you've only dreamed about. And you guys get a discount. So at checkout, carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15. That's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. That's carlywaters.com/course. Use code POD15. That's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. See you inside the course.
Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre and time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time? Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. This particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 31st of July, with the matchup emails going out on the 1st of August. For more information and to register, go to biancamaray.com and look for the Beta Reader Matchup tab, and please spread the word. The more writers we have signed up, the better the matches will be. Hi there, and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray, and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. Today's guest is the author of The Change, a GMA book club pick, as well as the groundbreaking YA series starring Kiki Strike. Born and raised in a small town in North Carolina, she now lives in Brooklyn, New York. It's my pleasure to welcome Kirsten Miller. Kirsten, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
It's wonderful getting to chat with you because I discovered you through The Change, which I weirdly thought was your debut novel. I was like, oh my God, this is such an assured debut. And then I realized afterwards that there are a heck of a lot of other books that you have written across multiple genres. Now, that's something we discuss on the show all the time, how frustrating it is how publishers want to put authors in a category. They want to put them in a box so it makes it easier to market them. And I have a lot of author friends who are therefore forced to publish under pen names when they write under different genres. And I loved how when I looked you up, there was your name, Kirsten Miller, across all these different genres. So can we speak about that for a moment and how you decided that that's what you were going to do?
Well, I never intended to. So when I first started writing, my first series, Kiki Strike, came out in 2006. And when I was writing it, I did not know that it was a young adult series. I was writing it purely for my own enjoyment. And, you know, to this day, when people ask me what age group it's for, I'll often say 30, because that's how old I was when I was writing it. But I never intended to go into young adult fiction. I just sort of was placed there by default because the characters in my first book were young. And I think it's as good a read for people in their 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s as it is for young people. You know, it was just happenstance. I enjoyed writing for kids a lot and continued doing that. I think young readers, particularly middle grade readers, are wonderful, wonderful cheerleaders for your work if they like it. And it's always wonderful when somebody comes up and gives you a big hug at a reading. So I enjoyed that. And then, you know, I went in, I worked a lot with Jason Siegel. I wrote quite a few books with him, and that was a lovely partnership. I enjoyed every second of it. But after that was done, I really felt like I needed to go back to really what I felt was at the core of my writing, what I started with in that first book, which was I had a message that I wanted to send to other women and girls. And I thought, if I'm going to keep doing this, because writing, as we all know, is incredibly difficult, I need to be writing about something that I genuinely care about. And at that point, there was a message that I really wanted to send to women my own age. And so I wrote a book for us. And that's how The Change came about. It wasn't something that I had planned to do. I didn't necessarily think, oh, it's time to, you know, hop into the adult world. It was just simply a matter of that's what I needed to say at that moment.
Yeah, I always say that I write from a place of rage. So I can't imagine writing for middle grade because I have a lot of rage. I don't know. Is it possible to have a lot of rage and write middle grade fiction?
You need to read Kiki Strike. So it's not, I wouldn't say it's filled with rage, but it is sure filled with, I mean, it is irreverent. It's wonderful. One of the things that's really great is that a lot of the young women who read it when it first came out are now grown up women out there in the world doing their thing. And I've had a number of people write into me and say that they felt like it was their first feminist handbook. And I mean, that just that makes my heart swell every time I hear it, because that's exactly what I was trying to do. So I wouldn't say it was angry, but it certainly was meant to cause the kind of reaction that I wanted it to.
Excellent. High praise indeed to hear that from your readers. And then we come to Lula Dean's Little Library of Banned Books. So I'm just going to read the flap copy for our listeners, and then we're going to get into discussing this. So Beverly Underwood and her arch enemy, Lula Dean, live in the tiny town of Troy, Georgia, where they were born and raised. Now Beverly is on the school board and Lula has become a local celebrity by embarking on a mission to rid the public libraries of all inappropriate books, none of which she's actually read. To replace the pornographic books she's challenged at the local public library, Lula starts her own lending library in front of her home, a cute wooden hutch with glass doors and neat rows of the worthy literature she's sure the town's readers need. What Lulu doesn't know is that a local troublemaker has secretly restocked the little library with banned books, cleverly disguised in the jackets of Lula's wholesome reads. Literary classics, gay romance, black history, Judy Blume novels, books of witchy spells, all just waiting to be discovered. As the townsfolk borrow books from Lula's banned book library, they find their lives transformed in hilarious, profound, and unforeseen ways. But when the truth about the library comes out, the showdown that's been brewing between Beverly and Lula will roil the whole town and change it forever. Dun, dun, dun. Now, I could understand what would have inspired this book because, my Lord, it's you just go onto Instagram, you go into social, you see the news, and it's just, for me, rage compounded with rage compounded with rage. But then I read the letter from your editor in which she takes us through the conversation you had based on, I think, her visit back home. So can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, so I was hard at work on the follow-up to The Change, which isn't a sequel, but it's in the same neighborhood, literally. It's set in the same town. And she wrote me a note one day, and she said, I was just in Austin, where you ride around Texas has some of the, you know, the worst book banning regulations or rules or whatever is going down there. So she was in Texas, and all of these people had lawn signs out that said, come and get it, which meant we have all the banned books, come and get them, you know, we'll loan them to you. And she thought that was such a wonderful idea. And she wrote to me, she said, well, what do you think about a little library filled with banned books? And it's not that I'm opposed to other people's ideas. I just generally have, you know, enough of my own that I'm working on at the moment. But there was something about that idea that just, it really started to sink in. I really started to think about it. I started to think about the books that in my library would be in my little library if I were to have one. I started thinking about my own history as a Southerner. And I wrote back to her and I said, I'd like to write this book. That's how it started. And I just, in a couple of days, sat down and wrote the first four chapters to see if it would work. And I think those first four chapters are still the first four chapters. Nothing changed. That's it. They just kind of poured out of me because it was a book that I felt I really needed to write.
And, you know, for our listeners who listen to the show, you know, authors generally say their first chapter either gets scrapped or it becomes chapter 18 or, you know, it gets moved around or a prologue gets added. So to have the final book have the first four chapters that you wrote is incredibly rare.
Well, I did the very first chapter, I did add that one first chapter, and then the next four chapters are exactly what they were. So there's the secret.
And we will get into that first chapter shortly. That's something I want to discuss. But in terms of your editor, so I'm assuming that this was a two-book deal with this particular editor, and it was a completely different editor to your previous books, or no? Oh, you've been working with the same editor this whole time.
You mean with my YA fiction?
Yes.
No. I've worked with, over the years, Bloomsbury, Penguin, Random House, before they were Penguin Random House, Abrams, now I'm at HarperCollins, the William Morrow imprint. So I've worked with a lot of different publishers. This is my editor from The Change, and I did not start with a two-book deal. I had a one-book deal for The Change, and then as The Change was coming out, I sold her a new book that was, like I said, not a sequel, but sort of in the same universe. And I was working on that when this book was proposed. And this was a whole new deal. So I'm going to be doing three books with her.
I love when we are sort of committed to one particular book, but then we have to cheat on that book with another book, right? Because that other book is becoming more alluring. Was it a case of you put that other book aside because you felt that the banned books conversation was urgent now?
Yeah, no, I wanted to get it. And, you know, we can talk about that too. The benefits and the disadvantages of putting a book out during an election year. But I thought that it was an important discussion to have right now. So I set the other book aside. It also happened to be, we all hit kind of the doldrums in a book, you know, where the wind goes out of the sails for a little while. And so I was at that point with the other book, and I was happy to sort of set it aside. And it's turned out to be a great thing, because when I picked it back up again, it was all there waiting for me. And I'm having much more fun with it now than I was before.
And that's a good lesson, again, for our listeners. You know, sometimes it's just a case of you need to put a book away, take some time off, work on something else so that you can reignite the passion for that original project. I think too many people give up on something when they get to that, oh, I'm not quite sure where to next. But really, it is just a case of re-energizing yourself and seeing if you want to come back to it.
Absolutely. You have to put things aside. The worst thing, I don't know, I can't speak for everyone, obviously, but the worst thing for me is to try and push something. Because the minute I start pushing, the minute I stop feeling the passion for the project, the minute that it becomes this horrible chore that I'm forcing myself to finish, that's when the joy and the love and the entertainment and everything, you know, sort of leaves the project. And I end up with something that I'm not happy with and will likely end up scrapping in the end. And I would say it's even time saving to put something aside for a week or two or even a month or even in this case, you know, like 6 months. You end up saving time in the end by not writing a bunch of stuff that you have to go back and scrap.
And doing the project justice, right? Giving it the passion and the energy it deserves rather than slogging through it, which I think is often a case when authors are on deadline. I think that's the worst. You know, when I speak to my author friends, when we hit burnout is when it's a case of this novel has to be handed in 6 months. And then you're in the middle of it and you feel everything deflating, but you don't have time to take time away from it.
The middle is the problem, right? There are always a few chapters right in the middle, which I don't know, they're the worst. They're the ones where you're sort of getting from, you know, point A to point B to point C instead of kind of feeling the story push you along. And those are always the ones where I look at whatever I'm working at and think, God, I'd just love to toss this and move on to something else. So I think it's a great idea to, when you feel that, set it aside. Set it aside long enough that you feel, you know, burning passion to pick it up again, because you likely will.
Yeah, act two for our listeners, that is where I think writers are made, because remember your act one and your act three is like 25% and 25%, your middle's 50%, and that's where you've got to torture your characters endlessly, throw as many obstacles at them as you can, up the stakes. It is, I always find the middle's tricky. Beginnings and endings, I'm like, I've got this, but the middles are tough. Can we talk, Kirsten, about what you said about bringing out a book in an election year? Because I know a ton of writers whose books were actually put on hold for, especially in the fall, publishers were like, we're not bringing out books during this election cycle. They'll all come out next year. So I think we're going to have a lot of books early next year coming out. So what's your experience in terms of bringing out a book right now?
So this book is inherently political. It's about book banning, right? And it is about, it looks at a lot of subjects. It's a satire. It is entertaining. It is a very, very funny book, but it does delve very deeply into a lot of very, very serious subjects in a funny way. But, you know, because it is about book banning, because it talks about subjects like racism, anti-Semitism, and rape and things of the sort, you know, there have been a lot of people who are very wary of spotlighting anything political right now, which I think is cowardly, to be honest, and very sad. You know, I wrote this because I wanted to do something that I thought was very important for this country, for my daughter, for the future. And, you know, it's been to see people shying away from a book banning is, I mean, I could say a lot, but I'll say it right now.
No, it is. It's depressing as all hell. These are the kinds of books that we should be discussing now. They should be highlighted at a time like this. Like you say, some people want to stay away from it. And I've, you know, seen tweets and threads from other authors who are writing about LGBTQ plus themes, etc., and their books are not being put in a lot of bookstores in the South. They've said that they've gone to have a look and their books aren't even being stocked there, which is, you know, doubly depressing because you've put all this work into it and people can only go and find the book and buy it if it's being highlighted. Now, I know that many of our independent bookstores in the South are putting up their hands and going, we're showcasing these books as indies, we're highlighting them. But I know that they go into chain bookstores and they just can't find the books.
We just registered my youngest kid for kindergarten. I cannot believe it. One of the tricky things about my kids being in French immersion school and not having French as a language myself is I'm honestly worried about how I'm going to assist with homework as they get bigger. They're young now, but I see it coming. We are honestly so lucky though to live in a city that's bilingual and we have bilingual friends and francophone friends. So I know it's going to be easy for our kids to pick it up. Me, on the other hand, I am worried about me. I grew up somewhere where French class was not taken seriously, and now I have to make up the difference. And that's where Rosetta Stone comes in. As the most trusted language learning program available on desktop or as an app, it really immerses you in the language you want to learn. Rosetta Stone teaches through immersion, which is a proven way to learn a language. Instead of memorizing and drilling vocabulary words, you learn by matching audio from native speakers to visuals, reading stories, participating in dialogues, and other practical language skills to fast track your ability to communicate fluently. There are no English translations in the product. You're honestly getting trained to listen, speak, read, write, and think in your new language, which is what everybody wants. Rosetta Stone users especially love the speech recognition feature. As you practice speaking, Rosetta Stone uses advanced voice recognition technology to match your audio, the audio from native speakers, and then give you feedback on how well you're pronunciating the words so you can really hone those pronunciations. It offers 25 languages from Spanish, French, Italian, German, Chinese, Korean, Japanese, even Dutch, Arabic, and Polish. This is the best language program because they have been an expert in the language learning field for 30 years and used by millions. Thousands of companies and government organizations use Rosetta Stone to support language training online. Of all the apps, Rosetta Stone uses the best speech recognition technology, so it compares your sound waves to those of a native speaker for better feedback to improve. They have a patented speech recognition engine called True Accent, which is built into the program. As you practice speaking, you'll get feedback on how well you're pronunciating words. The other language learning apps use speech recognition to detect what you said, but Rosetta Stone tells you how well you said it compared to native speakers. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. Think about the cost of a one-month language course. Think about the cost of one-hour private tutoring sessions. With Rosetta Stone, you enjoy lifetime membership and accessibility on desktop or app. We have a special offer for you guys. That's 50% off. That's a lifetime access to 25 language courses on Rosetta Stone for 50% off. This is a steal. Do not put off learning that language. There is no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, the Shit No One Tells You About Writing listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That we want you guys to go visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
Hello, listeners. This is Cece. Question for you. What do all the very best stories have in common? The ability to make us feel. Which is why learning how to weave emotions into your writing is so important. And I am so excited to announce that I am teaching my super popular writing emotion class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, August 8th. at 8 p.m. Eastern Time via Zoom to learn all about the craft of writing emotions, common mistakes, tips and tricks, and lots of practical examples from novels and memoirs you love. Then we'll meet again on Monday, August 12th, for a live cozy Q&A session in which you will have the option to turn on your camera and ask questions in real time. If you can't attend one or both sessions live, make sure to sign up because everyone who is registered before August 8th will get recordings 24 hours later. For more information, head to my Instagram profile and click on the link in my bio. I hope to see you there.
Well, let's, you know, instead of focusing on the cowards, let's focus on for a moment on all of those people who are standing up and doing the right thing. And I've heard from so many of them. And I, you know, as somebody who's from the South, I know that it is not easy. And I know exactly how much courage that takes. And so I am incredibly proud and more than happy to help in any way that I can. These people who are standing up for our right as Americans to read what we want, to buy the books that we want to buy, and to borrow the books that we want to buy from that we go to. And so I think that that's what my tack is going to be, is instead of, you know, calling out people who are not doing the right thing, I'm going to throw everything I can against supporting the people who are.
Wonderful outlook, and shout out to all the librarians, all the independent booksellers. Right, so let's start discussing more detail in terms of the structure of the book. So each chapter is kind of from a different perspective of somebody else in the town, so that it almost reads like interconnected short stories. It's little snapshots of people's lives in this town, and then the whole thing comes together. So just for example, within the first however many chapters, we have Ronnie's POV, Beverly's, Wilma Jean's, Dawn's, Delvin's, Crystal's, Elijah's, so it goes. So can you take us through how difficult that is, right? Because in the average book, you've got 80,000 words in which to build up a character, set up their arc. That's if we just have one POV character. You have now got all of these different characters, and it's your job as the author to make sure that the reader is invested in each of those POVs, that they find something to connect with, that it moves the plot forward. It is a lot of work. So can we talk a bit about that process?
Well, I think the main character is the town, right? So the town is, it's almost a character. It's an organism in and of its own. And I wanted to showcase each and every little part of it. You know, I think a lot of people, particularly those, I know a lot of people here in Brooklyn sort of look at the South and that everybody down there is of a certain sort. And one of the things that I was very into do was show that the South contains multitudes, right? That it's for every person down there that you think is like the image that one has in their head. There are a million different kinds of other people. There are gay people in the South. There are drag queens in the South. There are conservative Christians in the South. There are goat-raising hippies in the South. We are all sorts of different kinds of people. And so I wanted to really showcase each and every sort of person that I knew growing up in the South. And it is in a lot of ways a love letter to that kind of small town. You have people from all walks of life and all backgrounds coming together. Was it difficult? No, I really loved writing this book. I loved finding individual characters, focusing on a moment in their life tells a story about who they are and how they fit into, and then showing how they're all linked together. Like I said, this town is, it's an organism, it's an ecosystem of its own, and all of these people are interconnected. And so that was the story, was less about each and every one of these individual characters, although I think I do them all justice, but really about the ecosystem in which they live and how they're all affecting each other, how their histories are all interwoven, how you can't necessarily just pull one out, this image of the South, but it's all of them coming together that makes town function. So that's what I did. I loved doing it. And, and I love also playing with structure. Just that sort of straight narrative has never really interested much. I love tangents. I love stepping out. I love news reports. I love anything that sort of takes you out of that for just a second and adds to it.
Yeah, 100%. But I think what keeps it all so energetic is that we meet each person in a moment of transformation. This is not stasis that we are meeting them at before anything in their lives change. We are seeing them actively being challenged by things in their lives. We are seeing conflict. We're seeing tension. And with many of them, we actually see the character arc playing out. So I think that is, you know, advice to listeners who are doing the same thing. You can't just show people in a snapshot of like a regular kind of day. You have to be showing the tension and the conflict, how they respond to that, because that reveals character, right?
Yes. So that's the basic story is, you know, this troublemaker takes Lula Dean's little library, takes out all the books and substitutes them with banned books and wraps them up in the covers of the wholesome literature, like, you know, 101 cakes to bake for your family and things like that. The Southern Belle's Guide to Etiquette. And one by one, people in the town come and borrow a book. And that book changes them in some way, some unexpected way. And I really tried to keep those transformations very unexpected. It would have been very easy to have like people finding a book and realizing how wrong they were about something. That's not how it works. So each of these books changes somebody and you see that moment of transformation. And so that's exactly to your point. You know, it's not sort of a character study or somebody sitting in their house and, you know, this is what they do. So it's this real moment of action of, it's a pivot moment, right? From where they are heading down one path and they suddenly take a pivot and go down another. And that's what I think brings the interest and the excitement and the entertainment. And oftentimes it's very funny, right? They go down very unexpected roads. So
the satire was incredible, and we'll discuss that shortly as well. But, you know, for our listeners, we say that in terms of the structure of a novel, you need to begin with an inciting incident that answers the why now, why today question. Why does the story start now and not in a week or in 2 weeks or a month ago? And then you move to sort of a key event, which is a moment of no return. And so it goes, and you can plot out your novel like that. So what Kirsten has done is that pretty much each of these chapters has an inciting incident for that particular character. So instead of this novel having one inciting incident, we have one inciting incident after the next. And what we see very clearly here, and this is something, Kirsten, when we critique opening pages and query letters of our listeners, is we say that we are not seeing causality. You want to, in a story, see the dominoes tipping over. A leads to B, which causes C, as opposed to A, B, and C are all these satellite things happening without there being any cohesion or causality between them. So when it came time to sit down and do this, was it a case of you were outlining it and plotting it as you went? Or are you at the point now of your writing career that you understand that causality, and as you finish writing one chapter, you know what you need to go into the next one to show how the momentum of the plot is moving forward?
This is a hard question to answer because it is something that I feel like I've always felt. And what I kind of do is as I'm writing, I read what I've written a lot. And I go back and I try to sort of take myself out of my role as a writer and really put myself into the role of a reader, thinking, okay, I'm missing here. Is there a moment here where I'm feeling disappointed, like I want something to happen and it's not happening? Would I, as a reader, question, you know, what the connection is between this character and that character? And it's really sort of looking at it as a reader that it helps me fill in those blanks. You know, I kind of know, obviously, where I want to go. I know the story that I want to tell. I am an outliner, right? So I will always have an outline that I'm working from. But it really is that kind of that reading through it and feeling it and trying to get a sensing lacking here. What is it? What is it? And sitting back and figuring, okay, so I need a better connection, a stronger connection between this character and that. There's no sort of simple answer to it. It's really just about this endless process of editing. Because I'm one of those people, it's funny because I hear people say, oh, I write the whole first draft and then I send it off to my, you know, agent or whatever it is. And I am constantly going back every day, reading over what I've written, feeling it out. And every day I'll have a different response, you know, those earlier chapters, because I have more distance from them. And so it's just this constant going back through it and reading it and trying to figure out, sort of feeling for those empty spaces, those connections that are missing, you know, the excitement, the crescendos, the everything that you want, that sort of emotional reaction, trying to see if I'm feeling that the way that I want my reader to feel it.
I work the exact same way, which is why on the podcast I say all the time that the stronger your foundation, the more you can build on it. If I feel like I'm building on shaky foundations and I am on, say, chapter 20 and I haven't come back and reviewed the first 10 chapters multiple times, then it feels very rickety. But the more I come back and get that solid foundation, the more I'm able to build with confidence.
Absolutely. 100%. That's exactly the way that I do it. And it's funny you're talking about the rickety, you know, foundations. That is exactly how I think of it. And that's where I get into problems, when I start going too fast, right? Or I start working past the point where my passion kind of waned. You know, that's when you start moving into this territory where you haven't put the thought into it. You haven't sort of gone back and read things as many times as, and I do it and I know I'm doing it and I know it's a problem. And more often than not, I will end up just absolutely excising that section that I've written, you know, that doesn't have the proper foundation. It just doesn't work. It doesn't feel right. There is a limit to how fast every writer can go. You know, I'm just somebody who needs that very slow process.
Yeah, I'm the same. Everything on top collapses when the bottom's not there. And so that's why that's my process. I know tons of other writers. Stephen King goes, write one draft, start to finish, and then you can come back to it. But again, this is why we say on the podcast, every writer's process is different. You need to find one that's going to work for you. And that's why I love hearing from different writers, hearing what works for them so that you can see there isn't one right way to do it. Kirsten, before we go, I'd love to talk about writing satire, because you can see that you are having a lot of fun with this and it comes across to the reader, who then gets to have a lot of fun with it as well. Do you have any advice for our listeners who are working on satire in terms of how much is too much? How much is just enough? How do you know when to rein yourself back and when to let yourself go?
Well, I never rein myself in. So I'll let my editor rein me in. So it was funny because I was reading my Goodreads reviews the other day, which I rarely do, you know, because I'm a sensitive soul. But there was one guy who wrote in, and this is the reason that I do go and read them sometimes. He has a thoughtful take that I think I've ever read, which he was like, I think it was Mark Twain said that humor always came from a place of rage. And he said, I feel like Kirsten Miller's work, funniest stuff comes from a place of rage as well. And it's so true, you know, and I suppose that's how I deal with things, is really, really angry about something. I find the humor in it, because I think that that's the easiest way to make your case and to enrage other people without pushing them away. That's why I wrote a book and it was entertaining and accessible. I read it. That's the whole point. You know, if I were going to sit back and write a book for all the fancy literary types out there, like, you know, I would have a limited audience. The change that I'm looking to enact would have no hope of coming to fruition. I want a huge group of people to read this. So I wanted to make funny and very angry at the same time. And I don't hold back. This book goes places that I think a lot of people will find very, very uncomfortable, but funny at the same time. And I think that that's important. I think you have to push people. I pushed myself a lot this book. I talked about things that are very, very sensitive to me and people that I grew up with. And I did it because I thought it was important.
I love that you're not editing yourself while you're drafting, because that's so important. And yes, I think people are much more likely to sit with their discomfort if they're laughing at the same time. Whereas if they're just feeling uncomfortable and judged, they close the book and are like, nope. But as long as you can keep them laughing alongside the discomfort, I think you'll keep them turning pages for much longer. Kirsten, thank you so much for this amazing discussion. For our listeners, we are linking to Lula Dean's Little Library of Banned Books on our bookshop.org affiliate page. If you buy it there, you support an independent bookstore who you know we love, and you support the podcast at the same time. Kirsten, we wish you much success with this, and we can't wait to see the book After the Change.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
A reminder that this is an unscripted program and our conversations have been edited and condensed and is not a full picture of our feedback or conversation directly with each author. As always, refer back to our written notes for the fulsome picture. Carly Waters and Cece Lira are agents at PS Literary Agency, but their work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly and Cece on this podcast are solely that of them as podcast co-hosts and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Literary Agency. A reminder about all the ways that you can support us as a show: rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, tell your writing friends about us. We'd love to help as many writers as possible. And follow us on our Substack newsletter. Get our stacked newsletter on a weekly basis, bonus videos, articles, essays, advice, and more. You can find it at theshitaboutwriting.substack.com. That's theshitaboutwriting.substack.com.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes.
Here's the thing. Ever wonder why aspiring authors spend so much time trying to crack the code about how to get published? That's because no one who's in the daily grind like me has put all the pieces together in one place. It's Carly Waters here, and as your senior literary agent on the podcast with 15 years of experience in publishing, selling books, and teaching the business of publishing, I'm here to give you the clarity that will turn this hobby into a career. Inside my course, The Author's Publishing Playbook, we have monthly live Q&A sessions to cover your specific issues. But for the rest, there are over 40 video lessons that equal 10 hours of learning with professionally edited transcripts. The course will solve all your writerly problems, except write your book for you. That's on you. My course is a masterclass designed to teach writers how to prepare, pitch, publish, and promote their book in today's competitive publishing landscape. It's for career-driven writers, aspiring and published, who want to understand how to succeed in the business of books. There are over 20 worksheets, downloads, and plug-and-play templates for editing, querying, and marketing. You get lifetime access for the entire 6-module course as soon as you purchase. As new content gets added, you have access to that as well. Don't forget, there's a mobile app on top of computer access you can learn on the go. Get started today to gain the career you've only dreamed about. And you guys get a discount. So at checkout, carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15, that's code POD15, when you check out for 15% off. That's carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15, that's code POD15, when you check out for 15% off. See you inside the course.
Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre and time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time? Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. This particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 31st of July, with the matchup emails going out on the 1st of August. For more information and to register, go to biancamaray.com and look for the Beta Reader Matchup tab, and please spread the word. The more writers we have signed up, the better the matches will be.